Outside.
Welcome to the Outside Podcast. Today's episode will be in English, as I will have an English-speaking guest, or let's say that way, a non-German-speaking guest. In the future, I want to do more of these interviews with like international gravel riders and other interesting people. So, yeah, on a not regular basis, you will hear some English episodes. But before we're moving over to my guest today, I have another few topics I would like to share with you. First of all, I have another podcast which is called Besenwagen Podcast, and we will have a live podcast on the 6th of September in Cologne. Our guest will be Tom Dümmler. I guess most of you know them, and as I have today in like a guest from the Netherlands, probably if we have listeners from there, you probably know them as well. So there will be a podcast with Tom Dumoulin also in English. So if you want to come over to Cologne, which is not that far away from the German Dutch border, you're more than welcome. The link to the tickets you will find in the show notes. Almost 2 weeks ago, I was at the Nürburgring, the famous racetrack in the German Eifel region, and I did there like a recon on a potential gravel race course. And what I saw was really nice and exciting. And I really hope that the organizers of the event will establish a gravel race next year. I don't know yet if it will be a UCI race or maybe even a German championships. I have no clue, but I will be somehow involved, and I'm really looking forward that this race will come to life. And same time while I was there, I was doing the 24-hour race at the Nürburgring, which is on road bikes, or you can do it actually also on mountain bikes, but I did it on a road bike in an 8-man team. We actually won our category, and I really, really enjoyed the time, I have to say. It was a good group of guys. I was racing in the team Legends, they're called. They have every year a few teams there on the start line and all riding for charity, so for a good cause, and was good. Then I was even doing on Sunday, after the 24-hour race, the German Bundesliga. That was also quite interesting. I was obviously already a bit tired, my legs didn't feel that superb anymore, but it was good to get a bit into the race rhythm and have a bit of a change of speed and so on. So yeah, that was actually quite good and intense weekend. On the 5th of August, I'm on my way to the United States of America for Steamboat Gravel. I'm flying to Denver, and then I will stay in Steamboat 2 weeks prior to the race to get used to the high altitude. I think the whole race is on more than 2,000 meters all the time, and Steamboat is already also on more than 2,000 meters. So yeah, it's good to get acclimatized. But before, some of you may remember that I was saying, I don't know, I think the last or the second last episode, that I will do a performance test or lab test, which I did. And we did that to find out what the reason is why my legs felt so strange sometimes, and I wasn't performing the way I wanted. So the results were actually quite good. I won't tell them now, but they were good, but there were, well, there was one factor which made my legs feel the way they felt. And it was good to find out and to actually get an idea on how my level is at the moment. So in general, I'm quite fit, but there's one part we really have to work on, and if we get that right, then I'm pretty how to say it in English? I'm pretty excited for the next races, and I'm sure I will perform again on the level I'm kind of used to and I want to perform on. So towards the World Championships, I think we are still on track, and I'm really looking forward to do my next races, like Steamboat Gravel and then Hoover Gravel, the UCI race in Belgium. So I'm really looking forward to that. And yeah, but now let's move over to our guest today. Today I have Laurens ten Dam with me. Probably most of you have heard of him, at least when you're in a gravel space, as he finished in the last years second, fourth, and fourth at Unbound Gravel. He's the newly crowned Dutch national coach, but also former road professional. He was riding 18 years as a pro on the road for teams like Rabobank, which is now Visma Lease Bike, or Sunweb, which is now Team DSM Firmenich Post NL. He did 10 Tour de France, finished 9th in 2014, and his last season on the road was actually in 2019 with the team back then, CCC. He was, in my eyes, the first European-based gravel professional, or at least someone who earned money with racing gravel. And yeah, he is, let's say, the OG. Some have heard here in the podcast maybe from the Dutch Mafia, Dutch Gravel Mafia, and he's the godfather of them. We will talk about that as well. And he recently finished the Tour Divide in third place in 15 days and 6 minutes, which is quite remarkable. We also talking about that, but it's unbelievable, like crossing the states from north to south in just 15 days and 6 minutes off-road mostly. That's quite strong. But beside being a cyclist, a really good cyclist, he is also a business owner with Life Slow Ride Fast. He has like multiple things underneath it, like a cycling kit brand. He's a podcaster. He has his own beer brand. He's organizing gravel events and so on. So yeah, he's for me a bit like a role model, because I'm going also like his way. Not that it was my goal to be like Laurens ten Dam, but it's just a coincidence that we kind of doing the same thing, but he on a much bigger scale. And it's interesting to find out how he's managing that all. But yeah, let's move over to Laurens. Werbung. If you have listened to this podcast before, you will know that I'm constantly traveling around between races and events, and often find myself out of my usual routine. You will have heard me talk about the impact of Pillar Triple Magnesium on my sleep. Now I can manage my bedtime routine and take my magnesium 30 minutes before I sleep, even when I'm on the road and only traveling light. Pillar's new travel packs are a game changer, and you have a super convenient and lightweight single serve pack with just over 2 weeks worth in there. For me, this means 2 weeks worth of higher RFV, increased restorative and fresher legs each morning. To give the new travel pack a try, use the code OUTSIDE for 15% of your first purchase at pillarperformance.eu. That is OUTSIDE, all capital, AUTSAID. But you will find all details also in the show notes. Werbung Ende. Hey Laurens, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Just home from the tour. It's day one when you're home, so everything is still nice, you know. And probably you know about day two or three after a grand tour. You know, I did not race the grand tour, but I was there. Then the first fight start, or the depression kicks in, you know. So right now I'm still good, and I'm still on the high of working 3 weeks my ass off in the Tour de France.
Yeah, but you kind of did a Grand Tour before the actual Grand Tour, before you went to the Tour de France to do your daily business, but we're coming to that a bit later. But first of all, let's start with like a quick A or B quiz. I guess you know how this works. And say either A or B or the thing I say. Two by or one by?
Two by. What, A?
Yeah, two by is fine.
Okay.
Hardtail with drop bars or gravel bike?
gravel bike.
Wine or beer?
Which one is? Do I have a buy? Like a joker?
Yeah, you're.
No, with the knife on my. Then it's beer. Then it's okay. Beer. Yeah.
IPA or lager?
IPA.
Race suit or jersey bibs?
Jersey bibs.
Sitting on or pulling?
Pulling.
On feeling or power meter?
Feeling.
Road or gravel?
Gravel.
North Holland or USA?
Ooh, difficult one, difficult one. USA.
Yeah, we're coming to that later. I think that's also a really interesting part in your life. Spirit of gravel or all out racing?
Spirit of gravel.
Style or speed?
Speed. Yeah, style. That means like no aero. I never wore aero socks. So then it must be style.
That must
right?
be style.
Then it must be.
Unbound or UCI gravel roads?
Unbound.
Hotel or camper van?
Camper van.
Camper van or camping?
My camper van could be on the camping, so both. But you know, in terms of camping or wild. You know, camping in the wild or being on like a normal camping, then it's camping in the wild.
Bikepacking events or one-day races?
Moving more and more to bikepack events,
And the last one, I probably know the answer, but I'm still asking it. Thomas Dekker or Niki Terpstra?
Ooh. Yeah, it must be. It's difficult. They're both close. But Thomas must be closer, then it's Thomas. Otherwise, he kills me. If I say Nicky, Thomas will kill me. Nicky can handle it.
Exactly.
Nicky could handle it.
I mean, Thomas Dekker is kind of like an adopted son. Ne?
Exactly. Son number four. Yeah,
so.
But Nicky is also really high in my list of people I admire or I trust. You know, so Nicky's also a really good friend or a good fella.
I mean, probably some people know that because I mentioned it already a few times. Like, you're also like the grandfather of the Dutch gravel mafia.
Dutch mafia.
So you're anyway already the big dog there. So it's all your sons, Jasper Okolon as well. So
yeah. Anyway. So never. I made a comment in the podcast. I was defending Case Ball and Kev. You know, Case Ball is part of Nicky and me's training group, North Holland's Best. But you know, I was put under pressure by Thomas and Stefan and Jim, and I said something like, "I don't know if there was nothing. What happened? Nothing happened." And then he phoned me today. Oh, yesterday we were on the phone, and he said, "Never take sides against the family again."
All right.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So Nicky, you know, like. I was maybe the first. I might be too nice to be the real godfather. Nicky can be like.
Nicky has the aura. When Nicky is sitting there, like,
exactly.
he could be. That's actually true. Yeah.
He could look at you or not look at you, and you're like, okay, I've done something wrong.
That's true. So you just mentioned you came back from France.
Yeah.
What did you do there? I mean, I know you were there for like the Tour de France.
Yeah, but I can tell the people. No, so like I have a podcast, or we have a podcast, me and Stefan Bolt. We started it in 2018 already. It's called Live Slow, Ride Fast. And in 18, I did the Tour de France myself, and 19 too. And then we recorded basically, I think, 5 podcasts each Grand Tour, because I also did Giro d'Italia. 5 podcasts during the 3 weeks, you know, a little bit like Geraint Thomas is doing now, but that was like early.
And they're doing it every day. And then that's also crazy.
But also G is not there every day, I guess, now. Now it's more Lugo together with... But for example, the Giro last year, when he got second at the end, because Rohits popped him in the final every day, because... He was he was wearing the pink jersey and doing a podcast every day. So you want to know what he's saying. I think that's also yeah, that was part of me already before I started the podcast. But I was always really open to the public. I was one of the first guys who was using Strava. Mm-hmm. Twitter was even before that. So, in the I was the most followed athlete on Strava. I had a lot of Twitter followers. I started my podcast. So that's how the ball got going, you know. And then after the tour, after I retired from the World Tour, we stepped up the podcast game a little bit. So we put it into a company. Before, it was just me and Stefan recording podcasts for fun. Mm-hmm. Or we made a little bit of money, but then Stefan stopped doing what he was doing. He was making good money as an interim manager, but he wanted something else in his life. I had to do something else in my life. So we started to build like Live Slow Ride Fast as a company, with podcasts, with movies, with clothing, with everything. And in the tour, that's basically the pinnacle of our year, because that's still the most important bicycle event existing, you know. And then we record a daily podcast at like two times a day. In the morning we do a preview. In the afternoon we do the recap of the stage. Thomas Dekker is there because he's like the Messi of the podcast, you know. We give him all the free kicks he can score the penalties, you know.
Yeah,
like,
but
he's there.
Also the way he looks, he's always topless.
Yeah.
always
naked.
Always naked.
Maybe we come to that. He likes to show his guns. Yeah, yeah. In Oklahoma, they don't like that.
Yeah, we come to it later. Yeah.
No, but but I know Thomas since he was 14. I was 18. You know, so we go back a long time. We were starting cycling at the same club in Alkmaar, in North Holland. And he had a different path in life, but we came back together. I think 2021. We did so. I did some podcast in Italy, and I invited him as a guest. And yeah, that clicked again. Mm-hmm. And then we started to invite him more. So he's also there during the tour. And then we basically make 42 podcasts in 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And but we make it nice for ourselves. We stay in a nice house in the southern France. We record in the morning. We go on a bike. We record in the afternoon. We got two camera guys and one girl who does production. And then one who takes care of the house, basically. And then we have a nice small crew together, but we don't have to move every night to a different hotel and stuff like that. So we still don't see each other as journalists. We're just having a good time and commenting on the tour, and people like it. So that's, as long as we can do it this way, we keep on doing this.
Yeah. So like the whole slow ride fast thing, when you started the podcast and you said you founded a company, was there always like a plan to do like then clothing and these things? I mean, you're also organizing gravel events now. You have also your own beer brand, or maybe you just put your label on the beer. I don't know. But
it's a label.
Yeah. But you're doing a lot of things.
It's Claremont. Yeah, it's a lot, but it basically comes all natural. But Live Slow Ride Fast actually existed before the podcast. You know, I came back out of the US in 2017. I came back to Alkmaar with my wife and the kids. And it started with t-shirts and coffee, and we made a manifesto and a website. Me and my wife, basically together with somebody who helped us, Paul Santer, who's still doing the PR now for Jayco Alula. So he's a guy who's a storyteller. You know, I knew him from my Rabobank days or Blanco days. He did the transition from Rabobank to Blanco. He made a nice story around that. So, and then I started the podcast, and that was like the Kickstarter, because suddenly you have an outlet where, like, right now it's, I think, 50,000 downloads each episode. Yeah. And then, we make, I don't know, 40 during Tour de France alone, you know? So it's a big audience we reach. And and then you can also, the 2018 was actually also the first year of the gravel events, because I was inspired because of my year in the US and try to bring it to the Netherlands or to Europe. So it's all pretty natural, it comes, but altogether it starts to be a company, you know. We have an office now, like 4 months ago we opened our office in Amsterdam, and there's people, and it's actually starting to grow, and that's nice.
So like you mentioned you were in the States doing your time in the World Tour. And I remember, I think back then, at least what I could read in the press was, I think you went from back then Rabobank or Blanco, I don't know how the team was called then, it's now Visma Lease a Bike, to Sunweb, which is now Team DSM, Firmenich, Post and L. I had to write it down to remember all the names. And so you changed the team, but I think part of the deal was that you were allowed to live in the US. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, like back in 2015, it was actually already Lotto Jumbo, something like that. It was already Yellow Quotes. It was my 8th year in the team. And in 14, I got 9th in the Tour de France for Belkin. And I wanted to do better, you know, so I started to be more, back then it was not like now the trainers, the nutritionist and everything. It was really like a small team because from Rabobank, a lot of money was a lot less money than the Rabobank days. So you could do everything yourself. So I started to train more. I started to eat less. I was even more skinny than I used to be because I was already a skinny guy when I got 9th in the Tour. And, you know, I didn't perform at all in 2015. And then I remember the Tour de France was a disaster. I crashed in the Ardennes and my shoulder popped out and I finished the Tour. And I remember I was on the second rest day with Bram Tankink. We did like a small loop together, just the two of us, because we were the two depressed guys. And I said to him, we were drinking coffee. I said, man, I had my kids already. Like Jens was 4 and Bodie was 1. I said, man, I'm not the dad I want. I was aspiring to be, you know, I'm just a grump. And then when I counted the days back, so from the Champs-Élysées 100 days back, out of those 100 days, I was 90 days from home doing altitude camps, racing into the Swiss or whatever, and recon the Alpine stages. And the 10 days I was home, I was grumpy, I was hungry, I needed to lose weight or whatever. I said, man, this is not what I want to be. And then 10 days after the Tour, I got hit by a car and my back broke. My back was broken. And I remember I phoned my manager, he's João Carraia. He's a Portuguese guy, but the US Portuguese guy. And I phone him and I say, man, just stop all negotiations. I go to the US and I go race for Jelly Belly or whatever, small continental, you know, doing the crits and Tour de Gila or whatever, you know, a small US program. And then he said, ho. He was, of course he was not so fast. He knew something about my troubles, but he didn't know, like, it was like that high. And then he said, not so fast. He said, what if I can make you a team? You can live in the US and race the Tour de France. And I said, of course, that's a dream scenario. But come on, everybody from the US needs to go to Girona, you know, and you cannot pull that one off. And within 1 month, I signed my contract with Sunweb. So within 1 month, he made it like it was not against the rules, but it was against the common
the unwritten rule of like not Europeans actually living not in Europe and racing in the world, which is, I think, these days more common because it's easier to fly back and forth and also more money involved. So
back then it was not. Only Chris Horner did it, I guess.
Yeah.
So back then, but all the other American guys lived in Girona or Italy or wherever, you know, Ted King and those guys, and Zabriskie and Armstrong and everybody. So then I moved to the US for 1 year with my wife and the kids, and I only did racing in March and July and to the Swiss, June, July in Europe. So the rest I was in California. And then I became the dad again I wanted to be, you know, like every morning before my ride, I wrote a little loop in the harbor of Santa Cruz, you know, with my oldest son. And, you know, I was there. I was also, there was no journalist because I could say, if you want to speak to me, you have to come to the US, you know. Also with the time difference, it was nice because, you know, after it's 9 hours difference. So after like 11 a.m. or 11 in the morning, no, everybody in the Netherlands was already at night. So it was back the love for cycling. basically there I did my first gravel race. It was also because of João. Because before I moved there, I thought, you know, I was an old school cyclist. So my first race was Paris-Nice. Now it's very common. Mm-hmm. But back then I was like, you need race rhythm, of course, because you cannot start Paris-Nice without having one race in your leg. So I wanted to do those US crits, like the criterium races. And it turned out that because I was a world tour rider, I was not allowed to start those. And then my manager, Joao, said, yeah, but here we have those grasshopper gravel races. I said, what is it? Yeah, he says, Levi Leipheimer is competing and Ted is doing them, Ted King and Geoff Cabouche. And he said, it's really high level. And then he arranged me a bike and I started to do those. I did two before Paris-Nice. And I was like, man, this is nice because we went really fast. And I remember I got fourth in the first one. Like, I think Ted won and Levi Leipheimer got second. And then Geoff Cabouche would. Turned out to be an Olympian mountain biker. I didn't know him, but he was strong. But third, I was fourth. And on top of that mountain, we were just drinking beers and eating chips and having fun. And we waited for the first 30 other guys to arrive. And they're like, oh, you're flat. And we had like a chit-chat for one hour. And then I went back to Santa Cruz, you know. And those days were like, I remembered cycling when I was a junior. And I was like, I still like to ride my bike, but I don't like the pressure of the world tour anymore, of the pressure of being 64 kilos at 1.84 meters, you know, like I just want to be 68 or 70 kilos again. And then, then actually I went back home 2017 and I thought that would be my last year. But then also Tom Dumoulin, he won the Giro and I was like his main man. And so that extended my career again. And I met Nicky, who was living here with his training group, with Nicky and Kees and Ramon Sinkeldam. So I had a nice group of people to train together here in North Holland. And suddenly I'm still riding my bike, you know. Yeah. So I was not fed up with the bike itself. I was fed up with the pressure and the being away from home too much without being nice when you're home, because you still have feel the pressure, you know, and all that is gone now, so that's nice.
Yeah. So then 2019 was your last year with CCC, and then you were 30 years old. You decided to step away from road racing, but then you kind of went to...
Yeah, I was 38, eh?
Yeah. 38, yeah.
Yeah.
And... I'm 38 now, so...
Yeah.
And so then you stepped away from road racing and went into gravel, but then COVID happened, so the pandemic came. And what was your plan, like, going into gravel? Did you actually had a plan, or was it just like, all right, I'm just start doing it and I will see what's
actually
coming out?
That's the thing, you know. I remember we recorded a podcast, I think the end of 2019, or just before COVID, or maybe even during COVID, because then Stefan, the host, like my business partner, he asked me like, what's your ambition for Unbound? Or if you do, I said, man, if I start to train like I used to do to get a top 10 in Unbound, you can kick me right off my bike, you know, like. So right when and then the first Unbound came, like the year after, so we had COVID, and COVID was basically not a lot to do except for riding your bike. So me and Nikki, we're doing a lot of long training rides. And then the first Unbound came, I did in 2021, and I got second, you know, and I a lot of attention, and I liked it. And my wife said, yeah, if you're good at doing this, why don't you keep on doing this for a few more years? So I got right back into the training schedule, you know, in the schedule of doing things again.
Yeah, but like, did you feel the same pressure as like on the road? Or
no,
it different?
No, not at all. No, not at all. The thing is, that's also because a lot of people ask my wife, yeah, man, he's still gone a lot, you know, and why don't you? And she always replies, yeah, but she always replies to me, at least. The difference is when you're home, you're always happy. You know, if I go to Big Sugar for a week and I have a flat tire because it's sharp rocks over there in the final, I will be the same Lawrence than when I would have won the race. Yeah. You know, so that's the main difference. You know, and before, you know, I did Paris-Nice and she always had to it was always a surprise how I came home. Was I happy, or did I do not good enough according to my own standards? Maybe other people did too good according to my standards, like that's not possible. Maybe I needed to lose 1 kilo before the tour of Catalunya, you know, 1 week later, because I wanted to lose the kilo, you know. And if I wanted to lose 1 or 2 kilos in 1 week, she knew it was not going to be a nice week, you know, because, yeah, we're like underfeeding. You're not the most happiest person on earth. So the main, the main difference is I'm always happy and it doesn't matter, you know, like, also right now my career has been like everything was there, it's nice, but I don't like it, it won't change my life, you know. For Eva, for example, Eva Slick, he won a mount 2022, I think
23,
like I think
no 22 sorry 22
That changed his life. But for me, if I would win it or not, it would it won't it won't make any difference, you know. I still have my, and but he became like a pro cyclist because of that, you know. Back, and the same for maybe some girls who won a mount. So no, for me it's a, I'm way without the pressure. But what I meant is I'm not training as much. But before a mount, I'm still like a pro. Yeah, I'm a fit cyclist, so you have to train. Yeah, for that. But I'm still training.
I mean, it's like, I know you obviously for a long time, but we never really spoke.
Yeah.
But we raced together or against each other more. Or no, not really against each other, because when you were in the front, I was usually not in the front because it went uphill. But
in the world,
but we did the same races. And but I find it interesting, as you said, like for Eva, winning Ambon changed his life, and for you it won't. But I think it's also because you have build like your own company and everything, and you have anyway already like a market value, you know.
Exactly.
And you're not coming out of nowhere, but it's an interesting point. But
and also it's it would be like, I don't want to be the four, I'm 43 now, right? So I'm old, and I won't be, I don't want to be the 48 year old guys who still try to win a mount, you know, like that doesn't need to be like that. So I'm happy the way it goes. I'm happy to stay fit. I'm happy to try to beat you young guys, although you're still 38 already, you know. But no, but I'm happy to. But, you know, if the upcoming, also my kids grow older and they perform on a pretty high level in like soccer and baseball. Also, you know, you want to be at their games. Like their games in the weekend are more important than my training. Yeah. Well, like 5 or 10 years ago, there was the other side, the other way around. And that's also, that's okay, you know, it's like a life cycle, and I'm okay with that. Yeah.
But do you think you need competition in your life in some way?
Yeah. Yeah, some way. We made a movie about that last year, and it's in Dutch, I guess. But somehow I need to pin on a number, you know, like somehow I even had that as a pro cyclist already, you know, in the winter, a lot of pros, they didn't want to do the beach racing. And then you go somewhere, you know, on the beach here in North Holland, in Julianadorp, 8 a.m. It's barely light. And it's like the wind is like across the beach at, you know, 6:04. And you're on the first line with like 50 or maybe 100 hungry young beach racers around you, you know, who want to kick ass and don't break and blah, blah, blah. And then in the morning, you're like, what? Why did I want? But then you do the race, and then you go back on the bike with because it's always a bike distance for me. And then you're like a different happy dad somehow in the whole afternoon, because you had your like endorphins and you had your Edward. So for me, a beach race in December was also really nice to do. Well, I know plenty of pro racers who are just training and are okay with not racing in winter, but. So I always said like 4 or 5 times a year, at least a number, just to feel the adrenaline. It's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess also road cycling has changed so much that you actually, that there's no space for that. And we are luckily still in a sport or like in a discipline of cycling where it's kind of possible.
Yeah. But also that's changing. Maybe that's the way that's why I'm diverting more and more maybe to bikepack racing or I've done a few now. Although the last one took so much out of me, I didn't know.
Before we come to the divide where you recently finishing third. The whole thing with like competing and getting older. I mean, I'm a bit younger than you, but I'm also like closer to 40 than to 30. And I'm also asking myself, like, when is the point to stop? I mean, I don't see it yet because I still feel fit and getting better and so on. But I'm still racing with 50. You know, do I still feel that need in me to like pin a number on? And I like when I retire with like 30 years old on the road, I was like, okay, that's it. You know,
I'm done.
But then it's crazy to actually. I think, I guess there are people, I mean, Andreas Stauf,
I guess you'll feel it. I know Stauf, he's working with you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's doing the podcast with me and he's like the opposite of me, you know, he doesn't want to put on a number, but I'm like, I'm driven by that, you know, I need this competition and
exactly.
Will it ever end, you know, that's the thing.
Yeah, I don't know, but right now I got the feeling, you know, I'm still within 1 month of Tour Divide, but right now I've got the feeling I'm not racing anymore this year. You know, so maybe you have to do something really crazy that, you know, because you're always searching for the adrenaline and that rush, but that rush was so long and so deep that, I'm also national coach for the Dutch Gravel squad, but I qualified myself too, but I'm like, it might be better maybe to arrange everything really good for the athlete and not race myself, then do everything half, like be half a racer, but also it's not arranged as good as it could be for the other athlete, you know? So, and right now I'm more towards, I might be just with my car, I don't know, track suit or whatever, next to the road and make sure everything is arranged pretty really good for the athletes who can actually win the race, you know, at some point you'll feel it. I got the feeling before Unbound, the feeling with my kids missing too much baseball of them, you know, like next year I'm not going to do a 3-week trip to the US anymore before Unbound, you know, so that's already then you start to cut things.
And but how did the whole national coach thing came? Like, did they ask you or asked them?
Actually, I asked them. So I proposed them. So last year I did the Worlds, and there was not like a coach. The guy was technical.
We have the same in Germany. Yeah, technical. There's no one basically.
Yeah. No. So the guy who's actually head of all coaches was there because it was no other coach's responsibility. Mm-hmm. So it was not the road coach. Not. And I saw him and I know the guy. It's Wilbert. It's a nice guy. And I told him like, man, I need you to help out. I know the sport. You know, I know. I can help. You know, we can help grow the sport. In the Netherlands, and he went to, we also organized with the company, we organized like the illegal after party at the Worlds, and he was there and he saw how much fun we had, but also how many pro riders came. For example, Florian Vermeers was there. We took him under our wings the whole week and Wout van Aert came, you know, and some Dutch guys. And he said, this is basically the same as what was the first Grasshopper. You know, we had a big race during the day and then in the night we had fun together. And I said, but that's how that's how we should get the Dutch gravel going, that direction we should go, you know? So it needs to be we should race hard. I made like a plan. We race hard, but we also have the most noise, the most fun of all nations, you know. We are the most arrogant. We have the most fun. We have the most the best party, the best after party. But also we race to win, you know. And he really liked it. For example, for Dylan van Baarle, he's coming. I have 20 wild cards to spare, and I have got my guys in the peloton. Hey man, I need you. And he, just tell the team you're not doing Paris Tours, you go to the world. So he's coming. And for him, it can be the most nice weekend of the year, you know, a race week, because he's also in the team with the pressure and stuff. Mm. And I want to take a little bit of the pressure away, but still race hard. So I proposed that to him, and we went with it. I made like a plan, what I want. The plan consists of course, also budget-wise, you know, like it's difficult because the squad is really big, because everybody can qualify themselves individually. Right now, there's already... And then the last three races, I didn't add because they're not official. But like after Singen, I think, there's already 41 qualified men and women in the elite category for the Netherlands.
But just 20 can start per category.
Yeah, by the elite. Yeah, so the pro category, because the age group I don't do. And then I still have 20 wild cards, and then we have 10 houses, like, so it will be
But just a question, so like the 41 plus 20 wild cards, is it not, you have 20 spots per nation, per category?
No. You qualify yourself.
And then you still have 20 wild cards. That's new, huh? Because last year was like maximum...
Yeah, that's new. Last year it was not like that. So they
Bloody
changed the
hell.
Rules.
Fucking hell. That's going to be mad.
So yeah, it's going to be a really big... Because it's also pretty close to Leuven. Yeah. You know, like in 2 years, it's 2 years it's in Australia.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
So then a lot... But right now, a lot of continental riders qualified themselves, you know, because they're strong and they did Valkenburg, they did a good race, and you have to you qualify if you're in the first 25% of the results of the elite category.
Yeah.
So if, like, for example, I don't know, 160 people start, it's the first 40. Pretty easy if you're, like, well-trained. Yeah. So it will be big, but we do a big recon together with the whole squad on Thursday. And then everybody can go home because it's close, and we don't have money to put 70 guys in a hotel or rent a whole hotel. And then they can come. But Thursday we do a recon and a big barbecue. And then Dylan van Baarle can know, for example, you probably Atne Kosker, who got third in Valkenburg, but they never spoke to each other, for example. And so little get together, and then Sunday we race to win. But also in the spirit of gravel, I don't want to do too much team tactics or that stuff, you know. Like Dylan, if he comes, he can race to win the race, and he doesn't need to give it to Jasper Okkerlund, for example, you know. Like,
but do you have more road riders coming from the Netherlands?
Yeah, I'm thinking about so the girls, they're really interested in the wild card, so that will be a big squad. But for the men, I got now Mike Teunissen. Mm-hmm. I know Eike Visbeek pretty well. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a friend of mine. I know him since young time. And Mike was allowed to race because I said, Eike, I need Mike. You know, he's been world champion cyclocross with the juniors, I think, or U23. So he knows how to handle a bike on dirt, you know. And he's in the sprint train, so also out of the corners in Leuven. And he said, yeah, I spoke already about him, about the world's gravel, but I have some conditions. Either way, he has 1,000 points, or he wins a classic, or he does a winning lead out in the Tour de France. He is allowed to go, because otherwise he needs to go to Paris Tours, because the points are important to the team. And then he did the lead out for Bini.
Okay, good. Done.
So I sent both the texts. I said, okay, Mike, you're going. Yeah. And Mike was smiling, like, whatever. So it's that's what I like about being coach, you know, because I know a lot of those team directors. Yesterday I phoned with Jan Boven from FISMA, Lisa Bike Woman. Mm-hmm. Speaking about the woman, Demi Vollering will go. Lucinda Brandt.
But I guess on the women's side, you kind of need to make a proper plan, because it feels like that the women's race is more, not tactical is maybe the wrong word, but it has to be more on the team dynamic than the men's. The men's race feels always a bit like anarchy, you know, like last year it was just mad.
Yeah, last year. Yeah, but I think for them it's also nice to race
against each other.
For themselves.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, why not? Like, I don't care if someone, you know, if they were three Dutch women in the front group of five. Of course, I would love them to not make each other lose, but each one can win, you know. And so for me, it's of course we'll talk, and also it's difficult because, like I say, you place, you qualify individually, you know. So and everybody has their own sponsors, and everybody, I don't know if you have bonuses in your contract for becoming, I don't know, podium or top five in the world championship or somebody else. So that dynamic, I need to speak about that with them on the Thursday, you know, when we do the recon. But I can see everybody's individual interests, you know, so it's difficult. Gravel for me is still an individual sport.
Yeah, I agree, but we will come to it later as well, because there's like a lot of things happening. But then it feels sometimes strange that we're racing all year with our own jerseys, our own sponsors, and then even even European championships you race in your own kit, but then at the world championships you have to ride the national kit with national sponsors. Yeah. Like in Germany, my biggest sponsor is my bike brand, Orbea, and then the biggest sponsor for the German Federation is another company.
It's
pretty big on the jersey, and it feels not right. And you don't get any support. You're buying the suit and everything. It's strange. Yeah.
You have to buy it now. So for the elite, we give the shoes.
We have to buy it.
At least that's what I. I put that lightly. Because also for the age group, you can race whatever as long as it's a little bit of orange. Yeah. So then you could still make your own jersey. But I agree with you. You know, last year I also asked, can I do my specialized bib? And I sent Wilbert. I said, Wilbert, a picture of Yomi Seal winning in Lugano, because then he was wearing the Mapai bib shorts and the Belgian jersey. No, but I see that point, but I also see that the UCI wants to make the world championships like a real world championships with like national jerseys, you know. But I think, you know, in the old days, I don't know. Also, this federation, doesn't do it anymore. But in the old days, the pro riders had also their own sponsors on the national jersey.
Yeah, but you know, I'm a professional athlete, but I don't have a professional license because there's no gravel professional license. It's really kind of still complex.
They're supposed to change a little bit. I talked about that also with Wilbert and Gerben de Knecht, the three guys. Gerben de Knecht does the cyclocross, so we talked about, and I talked about that, and at least I got the socks out of the equation. You know, socks and gloves. So then, you know, like, because then I was like, yeah, man, at least they can wear their own socks, you know, and their own gloves and helmet and whatever. But I see your point, and that's, on the other side, also when you're not getting anything from the federation that weekend, that makes it even for you feel more like you have to pay your own hotel. You have to pay everything yourself, and then you're riding with another sponsor. That's difficult to swallow. I see your point.
Yeah. I mean, I totally think we should keep this kind of spirit of gravel alive. Like, everyone can participate. But I also feel the strong need, to be honest, especially in the elite, or no, actually just in elite circus, that we make, like, signed, kind of say, all right, if you want to have a proper UCI World Championships and you get a proper jersey afterwards, like on the road, like a mountain biking, then let's make it a proper race with, like, let's say maximum 10 per nation and not like 60 per nation here. And let me make it a proper selection and like really have the world best athletes.
But then The nice thing about Gravel is actually the mass participation.
I know, but that's what I just said. So it's hard. And we will see what will happen. I guess.
Yeah, we see how it evolves. So at first I was also hesitating for the UCI thing, the whole thing. The first year I didn't compete, also no UCI World Championship or World Series. But that year I flew, I think, 8 times over the ocean to race Lifetime Grand Prix, and I did 2 times Colombia, so 6 times US, 2 times Colombia. Yeah, that's not sustainable, you know. And then I saw 2023. I saw also how many people actually like those UCI series, you know, and have a good day out of it. And of course, it's more racy maybe still than in the US, but still, you know, it's still 1,500 people who likes who have a nice day and race. And if you want to pin your number, like you want to pin your number, you can also do it in Europe, actually, on a, and not in segments, but like in a one, I don't know, a loop of 150K, like in the Netherlands 2 weeks ago. So that's why I stepped over that initial barrier I felt. And I start like, okay, this is the way we have gravel in Europe, apparently. You know, that's a different way than in the US, but still it's a nice way to go out and have fun on the bike in nature together. But also it's competitive. It's more competitive because of the 25%. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of grumpy faces in Falkenburg who didn't make the time cut in the 50 category. And I'm like, man, come on, you know, like... let it spoil your day, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm also happy that I was also reserved when I came in. It was like, UCI doesn't do much or many good things most of the time. So, it was, but in this way, it was actually nice that they built something.
I think Verwekker did a good job.
They did a good job. They didn't screw it up. So that's already a good thing, and. Yeah, I'm also interested how it will develop, but the interesting thing is always when I talk to people about like course design and so on, you get a lot of like negative comments about the European races because they always see the American pictures like Steamboat, like Unbound. It's like all these like nice long gravel roads. But then they're just forgetting like how the infrastructure is here in Europe, that everything is close.
Everything is
closer together. It's a different... just different climate and everything. You just can't compare it, and then can happen that something like Gravel 150, 1 year can be a really fast gravel race, shorter race, and then the other year it's just like a mud fest like this year, and people complaining about the bike getting destroyed. But then...
Yeah, but there was also an Unbound.
Exactly, and I think that's gravel. Yeah. You can't really say, this is gravel, you know?
No, exactly. Yeah. It's every year different, and also the part of gravel is that you have to be able to deal with the circumstances, you know, so self-sufficient.
I think regarding course design, there's like a trade-off point where when the majority has the feeling they need a mountain bike, I think then we went a step too far.
And also the loops need to be bigger than the year one in Aachen, for example, you know. Like at least 40K, like three loops is okay, but like 10 loops, it's more like a cross.
Exactly, but then this is also really complicated to do in Germany because of the of the population, everything, but then maybe we can't have such big races here, you know. That's maybe then also just how it is. So.
But also in the US it starts to they start to complain in the US now about rider safety. It's a big thing now, rider safety, because all those courses are not like they're not like it's we race in normal traffic.
Yeah,
also there it starts, like if you, I think this week on Velo News or the old Velo News, it's a big thing about rider safety. And also because it's a lot of gravel races in the US now because you can make good money organizing them.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to buy permits you're just racing.
I don't know how, I mean, you make an event yourself, so you know how profitable something can be. But in the US, as you said, you have no permits really, and it's not like, I know how it is in Netherlands, but in Germany, like switching off a traffic light is bloody expensive and like closing a road.
Yeah, my event was in Germany, so I know it was in Hellenthal. And in the US, so that's why gravel racing is so booming, because the organizers, they can charge $300 or $200. If 1,000 people come, it's $200,000. And if the expenses are like low, then you can just really easy make $50,000 in a weekend, you know? So that's like, but also in terms of rider safety, they forgot about that sometimes. And that's where people start to moan. Also, for example, I don't know if you got that survey about prize money and Unbound.
No, I didn't got it, no.
You know, like, I think it was Betsy who sent that, Betsy And, all the pros, like, it's, I think, 3,000-4,000 people who pay $300, and there's no prize money for the first, you know, and also those things, they start. But that's also, it's part of a growing sport, and we'll see how it evolves, you know, but what I think, what's important to me is that, and also you cannot get it back, but the first year, Graffalocus, for example, where we were rotating with the five of us, or with the seven of us, things change also in the US because Europeans go there, you know, and in the US it's like common to rotate. And then if Nicky Terpstra, Jasper Okkerlund, and who was it, Ty Sonneveld come to a Bentonville local race and they're together in their front group with Payson, who's pulling till he's dead, they think he is stupid, you know. So it's also a clash of culture. So that's why the real spirit of gravel, like it used to be, yeah, that's that won't come back, and it's okay too, you know. Like,
yeah. Do you think
at the end also the European guys are just guys who started to race bikes because they loved racing bikes and they race like that, so they don't know better, yeah, you know.
But do you so like two provocant questions. Yeah. First one, do you think the Europeans taking over gravel now from the Americans, and the Americans thought they had it to their own, that it was theirs, and now the Europeans coming and taking it from them? It sometimes feel like the Americans really like try to really hold on to this like gravel being an American thing, but now the Europeans, UCI getting bigger, the Europeans coming over.
But also Gravelovers, the first US guy was maybe 12th or something, you know, so also they have to step up. And then you speak also, for example, to Alex House or Ian Boswell. Yeah. And the amount of training they do and the amount of training the Europeans do, that's a different amount. Yeah. So then, you know, as Colin Strickland, he could become fifth in unbound in 2021 when I got second in that front group. And I trained with him in Austin the week before and I saw his Strava and we discussed and he said, yeah, I had no morale. He did 12 hours a week for like the 5 weeks leading up to unbound, you know, he could still become fifth in the 320k race. Yeah, it's not possible anymore.
Yeah.
And maybe that's something they don't like. That's the same as what I didn't like back in 2015. Like I had to go on altitude all the time to be competitive in the tour. And now everybody does it, you know? So it's a change. And you have to go with or stop racing the bike.
Yeah, that's true. And do you think Unbound is overrated?
In
the sense of like it's life changing. It sounds big, but it was for Caroline Schiff, it was for Ivar Slick, and it is now for Rosa Klöser. Yeah. It is not so much for Keegan Svensson, it's probably not so much for Lachner Morten, but for newbies, it is, yeah.
Yeah, and also that's also temporary, I guess. Yeah. You know, like it also depends on if you're like stable on the top or if you're like a one day fly, then it will fade away. It's the same maybe with the Tour de France. I don't think the Tour de France is overrated. That's also life changing for Vakkerland, for example.
It's not. The Tour, it is the biggest. You know what I mean? Like the Tour is the biggest, but sometimes Unbound feels like we make it bigger than it actually is.
Maybe. I don't know. I see your point. Like everybody in Europe who wants to race gravel is thinking about Unbound. You know, that's the thing, how they learned what gravel is. But for me, that's still the same as the Tour de France. As a young kid, I aspire to be in the Tour de France. And I don't know how they say it in Germany, but in Netherlands, you're only a pro cyclist if you've done the Tour de France once.
It's the same. Yeah.
So, and if you win a stage there, then you're also everybody. Like when you're 50, if you don't do anything the rest of your career, and if you don't build a company like I did, you know, like I'm still relevant because of I think when you're 50, people will still remember you. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, you're the guy who won the States like 20 years ago. So for me, it's okay, you know. You also need to have like we say uithangbord in the Netherlands. Like you have to have like the pinnacle of gravel, like where everybody is looking at one time a year, because what are they looking at? Like one time a year cycling news, but also even the Dutch national NOS is talking about Unbound, you know, the weeks leading up to the event or after the event. So I don't see any other event would could bring that much attention to the sport itself.
You see,
I
travel roads.
Yeah. Now this year, I'm in pretty close contact with the organization because we do the after party. We host it. And
is it Sunday?
Sunday. Yeah, Sunday
night. So I should extend my stay until Monday, you say?
Exactly. Yeah, you have to.
Okay.
So it's like a corridor to the La Deuzeplein, and you know Leuven is a student city.
I know. I've been to Leuven quite often. Yeah, it's a nice city. Yeah.
So all the students we drag them to that square, and then all the side. There will be like a small VIP area for pros. If you want to mingle with the students, it's okay. But if you're out for art, it's not possible. Mm. So there's like a small area where you can be like with the family. So it's for you and your partner. Yeah, we will provide partner stuff, you know, because I think that's important too. But they're going to do a television production, the same as the Tour of Flanders, for the whole weekend. So that, I come to this because you say like the world is the same as Unbound. So it will attract a lot of attention in Belgium. Sports Hub will be the same as Tour of Flanders all over the place. So it's going to be cool, yeah. Leuven. Yeah.
No, because I mean, that's why I asked also the question in the ARB, Chris. I see the thing with Unbound and I want to win it myself because I know it also will change a lot for me as well. But it feels like winning world championships is so much bigger, and I'm sorry for all the listeners who listen to all the podcasts, because I always bring that topic up because I always ask people like Unbound or USA Gravel Worlds, but wearing this jersey is for me like so much bigger than anything else, especially in our sport, because you don't get a jersey. Okay, you can get the European champ jersey, but you don't get a jersey for Unbound. And like there's so much history behind it. Maybe it's also because we are Europeans and we grew up with like the whole history of the sport, and that's why maybe that's why I'm so attached to history. And world championships and a jersey has so much more meaning than.
But to me, that's more. I think to me it's more for the world championships is more for the good road pros who come. Well, Unbound is for the real gravel guys. That's how I look at it.
Yeah.
The world is run by Johnny Vermeers and Mori, who will race World Tour both, and Unbound. They come to Unbound, but they don't win it, you know? So
that's how I look at it. You're right. But no, let's move away from the topic. I don't want to get people too annoyed about it. So you just mentioned you did recently the Tour Divide, or it's like 4 weeks ago now?
Yeah, it started June 14th. But it took me 15 days, so June 29, I guess.
So you finished it basically a week before the tour started? Oh no, even closer.
The tour started the day I finished, so I was in a rush.
Ah, okay.
With the podcast, we had some replacements. Sam Omen from Little Trek, he did my place, and Jim van den Berg, the coach, he did Thomas' place, so we had replacements. So man, I could from the finish line back to my home or back to France, that could be already a documentary. Like what you experience are now, tired you are when you travel.
But,
and
yeah,
because you finish and there's nothing.
Yeah,
nothing.
Yeah. But no, but let's start at the beginning. Like why did you do it? Why?
I still don't know.
Why to divide?
Yeah, why to divide? So I got into that bikepacking thing. Back in 2017, I heard for the first time about to divide, I think, and Mike Hall. I did a ride from Amsterdam to Bonn with people from Patagonia, the clothing brand, from their head office in Amsterdam to Bonn, because there was a convention about environmental stuff. I really don't know exactly where it was about, but they asked me to go with them, and I said, okay, cool, it's 300k ride, and we go back with the train the day after. I was like, okay. And it took us forever, you know, that ride, because like flat tires and everything, but that was all, basically it was a bunch of influencers. And then I started to talk to them, and they started, and I said, like, well, what is this? Why don't we go so slow? Yeah, we do it bikepack style, blah, blah, blah. Some guys race bikepack races. And they told me about Tour Divide and Mike Hall and guys who didn't sleep. And I was like, man, those. And they told me stories about, because Mike Hall just died that year, about like not sleeping, and he was hit by a car because of he was on the wrong side. I was like, I'm never going to do all this stuff. You guys are crazy, you know? But then came COVID. And like you, I need to be competitive at least a few times a year, but during COVID that was not possible. And then in September there was a bike pack race. It was called Further Pyrenees, September 2020. And one of those guys from Bonne Bust, he phones me, said, "Lawrence, in 2 days I'm leaving for that bike pack race, Further." I said, "Oh, do you want to join?" I said, "Yeah, why not? You know, like how bad can it be?" And then suddenly 2 days later, I was walking up mountains with my bike on my back, on my and chasing Christian Meyer from Orica. You remember him? And man, I was my back was hurting because I did it on a gravel bike with 38 tires. Well, the winner was James Mark Hayden. Apparently, he was also a legend in the sport on a mountain bike. And you know, I got lost, and then I start, and I was stuck behind the segment where you couldn't, we're not allowed to ride in the night. So I start to drink wine in a local pub, you know, and then actually for 2 days, last day, I was like, never again. And then I finished, I got third behind Meyer and Hayden. And then 5 minutes after the finish, I was like, okay, next time I do this and this and this, and this can be better. So actually it hooked me. And then I did two or three more of like two, 3 days trips. I did Grand Guanche. Yeah, I saw you over there. At, and I did Further England. And I did Colombia this year. Also, so it was all 3 days and I won all three of them. And basically halfway 2023, I phoned Bas Rotgans, the guy who introduced me to all this. I said, "Man, if I want to do one race, like what's like the pinnacle of bikepack racing? Like..." And then he said, "Yeah, do I have to do transcontinental or this or this? Like, I think I'm..." And then he said, "No, Tour Divide. Like, no questions asked. Tour Divide, that's the race you have to do." So then I committed to doing that. And when I commit, I do something. And I underestimated it big time, Paul. But, man. So if you say why, you know, also on the bike, I ask myself so many times, why, you know, why do I want to do this? And... But you know, at the end, also like the why I'm good at those races, I just follow that line till it stops. And unfortunately, it lasted 15 days this time before it stopped. And man, so many emotions. I recorded two podcasts. Do you understand Dutch?
A tiny bit, yeah.
A little bit. We have in France, we recorded 2 hours of podcast on this, but it's behind our, so we have also paid subscriptions. Okay. It's just for the paid guys. But I have some links, I can send them to you. I listened to them yesterday when I was in the car back from France. So I recorded them 2 weeks ago and it all came back. And actually, this was the first time since the finish, I felt a little bit of joy, you know, about having to, and even a little bit of, we say heimwee. So what's the...
Yeah, heimwee, it's a German word.
Heimwee, it's a German word, yeah. So even I was suffering so much over there, somehow yesterday night I was in the car alone listening to that, all my stories about those 2 weeks on the trail, it's long, eh? And I had a little bit of heimwee. So I was like, man. So I don't know if I'm going to do it again next year or in 2 years or whatever, but... it's been quite an experience. I've been never so fucked in my life as after, man, that finish line, you know.
I saw pictures of you and you... I mean, I have seen you after races, gravel races, and they're also quite long and you look tired. But
no, this is nothing compared to
that. But your face, that was like... You aged like quite a bit in these pictures.
Yeah, 20 years maybe more. But also like even after the race, So I did the Colombia race, 3 days. And 3 days, I was actually pretty pushing last night still because Rob Britton, you know him, it's a strong rider. He was only 45 minutes behind me. So actually, when I finished Colombia, because I was still pushing the watts, I felt everything, you know, I was tired. So the last 3 days of Tour Divide, like, those guys were like 1 or 2 days in front of me. I had a guy like 12 hours behind me. So I was in no man's land. I told myself, oh man, I'm way better than Colombia, you know. I'm not suffering as much and blah, blah, blah. And then you hit that finish line. I had 2 beers of Coors Light. And they could even, if they brought me to the hospital, I think they would have kept me there for like 2 days. You know, I was so pain everywhere. My eye was inflammation in my eye, you know. I could only cry because of that. And my puffy everywhere. It was so bad, Paul. I've never been like that. And it took me actually 2 days in a hotel bed before I was be able to travel home, you know. So it was hard, but at the end, you know, when I was listening to those podcast, those 2 hours of actually me, myself talking to Stefan and Thomas about my experiences, I also felt again the nice feelings about being in the middle of the night with the stars, with the animals, or you know, hit a restaurant or hit something at exactly the right time that you're hungry and can eat, and people are nice to you and stuff like that. I still get goosebumps when I think about that one hug I got at the Brush Mountain Lodge. It's like the halfway point where some nice people are. We take care of you. We wash your clothes. The only time your clothes are washed, clothes are washed by a machine, you know, in those 15 days. And then Kristen comes out, and I just did a really long run. I did 670K basically in one go to go there, to come there. And she gave me a hug. You know, first time you hug somebody in 7 days, you know, I could almost cry there, you know, like that. And I'm not like a crybaby, but you're so deep in your emotions and so low in energy that, you know, it's on the surface. But yeah, why? Basically, that's why I said I would do it. And I always tell my kids that does what he says, you know, when I say, hey, pass up. Like I'm really pretty strict. But it also is the other way. When I say I'm going to do Tour Divide, there's like no doubt for like a few months that I'm going to do it. And then I do all the preparation. And then at my low point, and then also a lot of life lessons, you know, like I had a really low point just before Pinedale, where Alex House actually lives. It's like just before halfway. Mm. Was bad gravel, and I was hungry, and my ass hurt, and my Achilles hurt, and my knees hurt, everything hurt. First time I phoned my wife, I said to her, I don't know, man. I don't know if I'm going to finish this or going to, why? And she said, hey, stop crying, man, or stop, you wanted to do this, come on. Like, that's what she said, like, no.
No sympathy.
And actually I said, yeah, and no sympathy at all. She said, hey. And actually, after 2D5, I said, yeah, every morning, maybe I'm going to bring this power bank or this sleep, maybe yes, a sleeping bag or no. Like, I could doubt about all those things for like weeks, you know. And then you phone me after 7 days, you don't know if you still want to do it. Come on, fuck off. And then I sent also like a video to my friends, like my WhatsApp group of friends. And I said, okay, guys, you can laugh a bit, because I always act like I'm the strongest, of course. Like I'm. And then there's one guy in the group always who says, when you think you cannot continue anymore, you're only at 40%. And I always laugh about it. Like, man, when I cannot continue anymore, I cannot continue anymore, you know? And 15 minutes after that, I got a phone call from Stefan and Thomas. They were basically my, like, yeah, they were watching the route and the weather and whatever. And they say, Lawrence, there's a problem. You just done 250K, but the big basin is going to rain tomorrow morning, so you have to cross the basin before 11 a.m. And it's like 300K from there, and it's like 9 p.m. Whatever, you know, like it's late already. So from like almost wanting to stop, I got that phone call. I said, okay, let me think. And at first I thought, man, I'm going to lay down in front of the mud. You cannot continue because of mud, you know, like it's the same mud as Unbound. But then then you have to walk for 100K. That's impossible. At first I thought I'm going to sleep in front of the mud and leave the race for what it is. And then 5 minutes later, I thought, no. And then I phoned them. I said, okay, decision is made. I continue. And that's when I did the whole push to Brush Mountain Lodge. So I crossed the whole basin. So the guy who said, when you think you cannot do it anymore, you're only at 40%. He told that me at 250K. And basically I did 670K that day or that.
Okay.
Yeah, so far. So basically he was right, you know, but, and that's when I entered the Bruce Mountain Lodge. Like I almost fell over because I started like 2 a.m. two nights before, you know, like it was like a, so lots of life lessons learned over there. Yeah.
But, what was in the aftermath like the biggest mistake you made? Just like one you can point out?
No, I made, yeah, so in terms of mistakes, I had to actually, after day 5, I think, I had a few flat tires and not enough inner tubes with me. And then I actually hitchhiked to a bike shop, 80K. Away from the route, and that took 6 hours away, you know, that was like stupid for me. But basically that was like a nice day because I had a nice guy who gave me a ride in his pickup truck, and instead of being in a rush and feeling guilty all day about things not going as fast as it's as the first two guys, because I slept in a hotel for 6 hours, but then from waking up to going took me maybe 35 minutes, and Lachlan told me during Unbound I did it in 20. So I was feeling guilty all day long, you know, like stopping for bottles again or stopping the, like those guys, they just ride and they continue. Yeah. So that was the first day, like, okay, I cannot continue anymore. I have to fix this. I went with the guy who stopped next to me. I was fixing my tire on the road and he stops next to me and he says, are you in trouble? I said, yeah, man, I'm in big trouble, you know. How can I help? He was walking his dogs. I said, yeah, man, I need to go to a bike shop. In 2 minutes, I'm here, he said. He came back with his red pickup and we Googled the next bike shop. It was like 90 minutes drive, man. So he drove me there. We had lunch together. We had nice talks about his life. Mm. He was retired. His kids were living next to him. It was really nice. But it was the first day I was out of that rush, you know. So that was a big lesson learned. Like rushing for 2 weeks, that's hard, man. Yeah. It's like a war, you know. And the biggest mistake in general was expectations. So in at the end, also Stefan and Thomas, they made a plan, like, if you do this and this and this, in 3 days you're there. And the first day I didn't hit it because they didn't see the route. Actually, 2024 was the first year in New Mexico, the route detoured from the normal route and basically took the hiking trail. So instead of those 30K of hiking trail took like 5 or 6 hours instead of 90 minutes. So, and I didn't know it. And I had no network. So I'm on that trail and I'm like, man, how the fuck can Lachlan Morton do this in 12 and a half days? I'm like struggling and this and this. So actually I'm begging like, man, this must be new. It can be the old route. At the end of that stretch, I got like a little piece of network of 5G, and I immediately phoned Stefan. I said, Stefan, tell me this is not like, yeah, man, this is new. We didn't see it. Nobody knew. I was okay, man. And that's what I mean. Like expectations. You think you're going to hit Cuba, or I really analyzed Lachlan's record race of 12 and a half days. And you think you're going. And the same as 2015, you have expectations of becoming even better than top 9 in the tours or top 5, top 6, and then it doesn't work out and you feel so shit about yourself. And I this year we did Plateau de Baie and I saw I was still top 10 in the Strava file, and that was that tour I did. But I feel just shit because I was not hitting the numbers I was expecting for myself in terms of result, you know. So what I know now is that if I do a race like that just without expectations, then it would be a much, much more pleasant ride for my mind than trying to chase all those unrealistic numbers of hitting 12 and a half days. Lachlan did a totally different route, you know, like try to win it. You know, those guys are experienced bikepack racers. I did 2 or 3 3-day races, but I have no clue, man. Third night, I was hallucinating. I never experienced that, you know, like, that's what I learned. Like, man, if you do big things like that, don't expectate too much from yourself because you start to talk yourself down in the rabbit hole of, I thought I was like a noob. My kids say a noob. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what the fuck? Why is it not possible for me to, you know? And then at the end was again acceptation because I my cable broke of my shifter, so I had to single speed the last 500K. Also, funny story. I came home and my mother said, "Yeah, the last part, you couldn't shift anymore." I said, "Mom, the last part, it was 500 kilometers. Took me 2 days. only the last part you couldn't shift." No, but then there's acceptation again. Okay, like, so.
Yeah, but okay, but just one question. Like, so you say you might do it again, but do you really think that the next time you're going to do it, you're not putting too high expectations?
Same.
Because it...
Thomas said the same. You're a racer.
Yeah, exactly.
You're a pro cyclist.
Look at Thomas himself. You know, like, he prepared for, like, certain races this year. Like, he is long time out of the sport. You know, he kind of, from the outside, looked like he really, like, closed that chapter. And but you, I think once a racer, always a racer. It doesn't matter what it is, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Yeah. That's true.
That's stupid.
But at least
that's
I know
really stupid.
At least I know the route then.
That's, I'm,
no, but you're right. Thomas said the same. I told this also in those 2 hour podcasts we made, and he said the same. He said, "Lawrence, come on. You know, you always. That's why you've become what you've become, because you always expect the best out of yourself." You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
One bigger question for me, like, how do you see the development of gravel racing? Because you were like kind of, you are, at least in Europe, like the OG, you know, like you were the first, like, when you did it, and then I came afterwards a bit and a few other guys, but then it really exploded. And how do you see it from, like, the point where you did, like, grasshopper events in, like, California to, like, finishing Unbound second, tries fourth, and now more and more pro riders coming over from other disciplines, cyclocross, mountain biking, they're winning UCI races, world championships getting televised, a lot of money coming in, not just for road riders, but, like, also for to top gravel riders. Yeah, what's your view on it?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think that's what Lachlan meant. Like, he said something about gravel is now at the point where road racing was when I left it. That's what he said, and I see his point. Like, actually, also we touched it a little bit a few minutes ago when I thought Conor Strickland, he could still be competitive with 12 hours of racing, of 12 hours of training a week, and also maybe that's why Lachlan also moves more to those ultra things, and maybe I do it too more. Like, you can still be competitive in those ultras with a strong head, with a really strong mindset, you know? And it's not as data-driven or scientific as gravel is now, for example, you know? So I think for the real adventurers, like maybe Lachlan or me, you know, like we were early in that we moved on already a little bit towards the, because we have the same feeling in those ultras as we had racing grasshoppers back in 2016. Mm. You know, like, we just race and then we eat chips and we have beers. And Lachlan, he gave me his cheat sheet. Like, I spoke him after Unbound. He said, "Give me your email." And there's a lot of work in that. So there was, well, like, every gas station 24 hours open, every village with a motel, with a telephone number, with a restaurant, with a telephone number, with grocery stores, with opening times. He just gave it to me. Here, good luck. You know, like, he didn't care at all about me also trying to do it in 12 and a half days or whatever, or beating his record. Or he's like, "Hey, Lawrence, good luck. Have fun on the trail. I hope you do good." You know? And that's how we, that's basically also how gravel was back in, a few years ago. And that's also, I'm still really on good foot with everybody, basically. But I know Pete, I know Ted, I know you. But for example, I don't know Keegan that much. You know, I speak to
No one knows Keegan, really, I think.
No, but that's, but I mean, like, that's, maybe a little strange, you know, or whatever. Like, it would be nice if we have an after party all together somewhere, somehow, you know, like Gavin Lowe, of course we have, but he's not there. So, for example, now at the Tour Divide, the guy who won was 2 days earlier, and the guy who was second was one day. They waited for me, and then for the podium, they came to get me from the finish. They made me breakfast. They put me in bed, basically, because I was so. Yeah, that's. I went together with Ulrich, the German guy. And for dinner, I think Sunday night, we had really nice conversation about family life, him living in Spain and stuff, me and the kids and everything. Yeah, that's nice, you know, that you start to know those, Justinas and Ulrich, well, you are like fierce competitors on the road, you know. I think they shared a hotel room the first night. Like, there's only one hotel, there's only one room left. Okay, we could share, we split the cost. Imagine that, like, I don't know, Keegan and Jasper Okkerlund, you know, in Humboldt. Yeah, like, but so it's still, it's also not life changing for them. Like, both still have day jobs, you know, they're not professional guy racers. So, I don't know how it evolves, but when more money comes into sport and it's more competitive and people are, there's less camaraderie, I guess, you know, and that's also, it's okay, you know, it's also part of being more professional. But the good thing again is, like, before it was only Colin Strickland made some money, you know, but he always surfed the waves before he was a fixed gear racer, when fixed gear was really popular. The good thing now is young people can come into the sport without having a pro career like you and me and still earn money as a gravel racer. You know, in Belgium we have Daan Grootsemans. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
He's racing for, the Belgian guy who's racing together with Piotr Havik for Ridley. Like, he's never been a pro rider, but he's like living the pro gravel life now. And that's a good thing because of more money into the sport. So, it all has its pros and cons, but in the old days, a 22-year-old without a story never would have a pro contract. And now it's possible.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you see it, I guess, as well, like more and more teams coming in. I mean, we have in Germany this Rose Racing Circle and Groove Gravel. Groove Gravel just announced that they have no fundings anymore. I don't know if you read the news.
So
they have some good riders like Ben Perry and
The industry is difficult nowadays for the bikes.
I think they had the private investor that guy pulled out whoever pulled out there, but someone pulled out and there's no money left. So that team will disappear, I guess, end of the year. But do you think teams, like really professional gravel teams with like a few good riders will be realistic in gravel? Because, you know, like, so what I want to throw in is, like, you need to pay everyone well. I mean, I think you kind of know what numbers are paid at the moment for the top athletes. So you also know what 4 or 5 guys and girls will cost in a team.
Yeah, it can be it can be a budget of, like, it would be a big budget.
And do you see that realistic in the next few years? And do you think, like, televising the sport will be possible in the future, not just at the Worlds and so on? Because I think you are more involved in how all these things working.
To be honest, gravel is pretty boring to see on television, right?
Unbound for the most of part. European races, I don't know, to be honest. I think it really depends on the course, but
so compared to the other races, I think gravel is a sport to do.
That's right.
So that's why it's important that, you know, and that's why it's also so nice to see every UCI race. If the UCI race, they sold out within, like the first one we did in Austria, where you got second. What was it? Where Shonis? I don't remember.
Yeah,
the Austrian one.
Wörthersee.
Gravel Wörthersee. 1,500 people year one, you know. So I think we have to keep on the same as a marathon is also boring, right?
Yeah.
like yeah, but New York Marathon, I don't know how many people run and Rotterdam, yeah, and Berlin and whatever. I think Greffel needs to focus on that part of the sport, because it's also, yeah, it's pretty honest as a sport too. So the strongest wins normally, you know. So I think to me it's pretty boring to watch on television. Mm. The worlds, I've seen the worlds, the first worlds. I've seen the second one. I did myself, so I haven't looked back at the pictures. But I remember in the second worlds, I think it was also just 15 guys left last year. No, you were there.
Mm. Yeah, we're less.
15 guys when television started.
Yeah, we were even less. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So that could be boring, you know. To me, it's a sport to do for the people, and I think also for the federations, like the Dutch Federation, it's really important, because how many more people take licenses because of wanting to compete at the UCI Worlds, you know, or do the UCI. So for the federations, it's actually everything is going down, but gravel is going up. So I think you have to be aware of that and let that grow. And the participation make that important. And participation is also the way organizers can make money, because they cannot make money of TV rights.
Yeah.
You know, like they are happy when somebody wants to broadcast it, but they cannot make €1 out of it. But if 500 people more start, if 1,500 become 2,000, then it can be a profitable thing for them. And then they keep on organizing those things, because... yeah, we need races to race. So also the organizers need to stay happy. And I think that's mass participation is the way to go for organizers. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. What's basically my last question? I don't know if you have actually questions. Then you could ask.
No, maybe.
You could ask them as well.
Normally. No, I'm thinking, just ask the last question, I'm thinking about...
What's next for you? So, you already said, like, most likely you maybe not doing another race, and especially not the Worlds, because I think I will also... Yeah. I think going to be a good view, you in, like, a tracksuit with, like, a Triller 5, I don't know how you said it.
Socks.
Yeah, with, like, socks and, like a cap, and just, like, you know, making calls.
Oh, you mean like next to the race? Yeah, a tracksuit. What's next? Friday I go with the kids and my wife. I've been in the last 3 months, I've been home for 10 days. So pretty crazy. So we go for 1 month to LA, or we fly to LA and then we rent a mobile home.
Nice.
And then we go all the way to Seattle.
Okay, cool.
That's the plan. And we visit all baseball stadiums we pass. The kids play baseball, so I booked already tickets for the first 3 matches.
Yeah. Do you want to move one day to California, like completely?
So I was there for 1 year, and I remember October, November, we were on the beach, me, my wife, and the kids. And my kids were back then, I think, 1 year old or 2 year old or 4 year old. You know, and their hair was blonde because of all the sun, and they were playing in the waves, and they were on the beach. And I thought, this is the moment, Paul. So I said to my wife, Tessa, I said, hey, Tess, I think I could stay here. And she looks at me and she says, Lawrence, the appointment was for 1 year. We go home in January.
Okay.
And it stays for 1 year. And I was like, okay. No. I'm really happy here, and also we like I say, I was 3 months away, and I'm going 1 month again to the US next month, so I'm really happy traveling back and forward. So there's also a little agreement between me and my wife, like I can go back and forward a lot, but I'm not going to divorce because I want to live in California and she wants to live here. You know, that's not worth it. So I stay here, and I can be happy on a lot of places. And this is also, we met each other here. We are high school sweethearts. Mm. So we meet each other when we were 17, or we are dating since we're 17. And we're both from this area. And it's also nice for the kids to grow up here, you know, like on one place. But the oldest wants to play college baseball and the youngest wants to follow him. And then we made, so the three of us, the kids and me, we made like a little plan. If they both are on the same college, mom has to follow.
Okay, I got it.
So that's why I give them all access. Yeah. No, joking. No, it's okay. I'm having a great life here, and actually, I'm having a great life, so I'm happy.
Is that how it looks like from the outside as well? On your
No complaints.
No complaints. And race-wise, so you said you're gonna go to the US, but you're not gonna do Steamboat, I guess then.
No. At first, I wanted to do Granduro, Mount Shasta, Granduro, California, but they canceled it. I don't know why or how, but it's canceled. So, and then we decided because after I retired from the World Tour, basically every holiday was devolved. Last year was Sweden. And the year before was Steamboat. Mm-hmm. And the year before I did the Lifetime Grand Prix.
Yeah.
So everything was evolved around racing, and now it's basically that's what I said. Like to divide, it was somehow I feel like I used all the desire to race in those 15 days. You know, like I feel maybe a little bit like Stauffy now.
Yeah, but maybe that was the
Not come back.
Yeah, maybe that was the thing you really needed to like to be not hungry anymore. Yeah, for more.
Yeah. So that's what I really feel like. Like also, for example, Sunday it was raining in France. Yesterday I was in the car, and today I was busy with the kids, and at 5 I thought I could do 1 hour now, but I could also, I don't know, drink an aperitif with my wife, and then I choose the second one, you know. So the desire is a little bit gone, but also that's healthy, I guess. So after something like that, or after, like, I'm 43, I'm a professional since I was 23. So maybe it's also good to step down for a few months and then make new plans for next year. And for sure, I'll be racing my bike somewhere next year. But I don't know. Like, I don't know if you... I use the training app, Join. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that.
I know that.
And it's like it has like a score from 0 to 50. And normally, I'm on like... 50 is like Pogacar. No, maybe Pogacar is even more now. But when they made it, they said 50
for
is
humans.
Roglic.
That's for humans.
Yeah. So 50 is Roglic. And then I was always like 48 or 49. But I can imagine next year I start races, I don't know, with 44 or whatever, you know, like instead of, because you really have to train a lot to reach that level. No, I'm okay and we'll see. But I also have to discuss that with my partner, my sponsor, like not Tessa, but all the people who support me. We'll see.
Yeah, but we'll okay, there is not my last question, because you just mentioned your partners. Are these deals based on like, you as a person is like just like an ambassador for a company, or also as an athlete, or is a mix?
Yeah, it's a mix. So basically, my bike partner, Specialized, is the most competitive one. I think all the other partners, like Shimano, they don't really care. You know, if like also with me, is because all the partnerships are not me, but also the company from the podcast. So it's not just me personal, but also a lot of the profit goes to the company who makes the movies and does the reels every day on Tour Divide. You know, like part of me is also because I have the podcast, I have the movies, I have everything. So it's a mix. And like I say, when you go older, it's more like an ambassador thing, more like maybe... direction Alison Tetrick maybe then direction Matt Beers now, you know, like Matt for the company. And that's a good thing. My contract is ending, but the negotiations will be in the Dodger Stadium watching Shohei Ohtani together with Ben. I agreed on watching a baseball game and negotiating the new contract. So I think that will work out pretty well.
Okay.
That's how that works. So I like
that. Yeah, nice one. No, in that sense, you're kind of definitely like a role model a bit, because all the things you do, we had it in the off a bit. I'm doing it like scaled down, like a lot scaled down, but like we kind of doing the same thing, but yours is, your Imperium.
I don't know, man.
No.
Don't be too humble.
No, I should be humble because yours is definitely much bigger. And also the things you're doing with the tour, I'm not listening to it because it's in Dutch and it's too intense to like try to understand everything. But in general, it's like, I think it's great stuff there. And Yeah.
People, we got good reviews during the tour. People love it, you know. Also, it's like part of the daily schedule, you know, in the morning in the car and in the night, they watch us on television together. We got a lot of, and that's really nice to hear from people. Like, they are really sad the tour is over because they missed the daily vibe, you know. That's what we try to bring. And that's also what Live Slow is all about, you know. Like, they are a little bit part of, they want to be next to us on the couch, enjoying, I don't know, like, watching the tour, ride the bike in the morning, have the good food, have the good wine. That's what Live Slow is all about for me.
And I guess the best stuff is to do it every day with Thomas Dekker topless. That's
It's crazy, man. Oh, man, I got a nice story about that. I'm just telling that. So we had Sjoerd de Boer contest.
Yeah.
And then it was like semi-finals, but it was late and it was dark already, so I was not paying attention. I was like, I don't know, I was chit-chatting in the living room, and then one of the camera guys says, Lawrence, you have to watch this. And I walked to the balcony, and I'm trying to find the balls, you know, like, because how close they are. I thought, and then Thomas Dekker is there, like, again, totally naked, playing Sjoerd de Boer because he wanted to distract his opponent. I'm like, you motherfucker. And I still, he's blaming me for being in the US naked.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
okay. So we will end it after that. But just tell a quick story with Oklahoma, what happened there. First of all, I think everyone thought, including me, that the pictures coming up was just like a marketing thing or something, you know?
No, it's real. Yeah. They do it every year, or every month in the newspaper. What they so the mug shots are real. Now the thing was, we arrived there in Oklahoma. I think Monday night we go to the supermarket. We want to do groceries. Supermarket gone, like it was teared to the ground. So we go to the restaurant and we ask what happened. We order food. What happened? Because we couldn't make dinner. And they say, 3 weeks ago was a big tornado and it was the biggest one in 100 years. And the super, I said, okay. So the day after we said, okay, we drive to that restaurant with the car, we do our training, and then we have to go like 35K to the next village because there's a next Walmart or something. Like, we needed to do big groceries. So we do our training, right? 3 hours, you know, inbound training. Yeah. So we went fast. And we come back to the car, and then Thomas said, okay, it might be better to put the bikes in the car instead of on the rack, because we go also to the supermarket, and we don't want them to get stolen. So I'm on the other side of the car, put the bike in, I walk behind the car, and then Thomas is there with his, with a gallon of water, and he wanted to put it over me. First day he's in the country. He arrived on a Monday. This is Tuesday. And I was like, okay, whatever, you know, like, because in the morning I was making pancakes and he was already walking naked to me. And I said, Thomas, come on, put on pants. We're not going to do this for 3 weeks. Like, the house is in the middle of nowhere. I said, man, I don't need to see this for 3 weeks. Come on. So then he wanted to show me his affection to me, basically. Like, okay, we're still friends here. I'm going to shower you. So I was there and I still had my pants on. But my jersey was off. So I go to the driver's seat in between the two doors. I put on my t-shirt, bibs off, swimming short on, so nobody saw me. And then I heard screaming on the other side. And there's a guy screaming. Thomas was doing with the other half of the gallon of water. He was showering himself in between the doors. For him, he was pretty decent according to his standards, but Oklahoma standards are different. And there was a guy screaming, and I throw him the towel. I said, Thomas, I said, come on. Like, I was pissed. And he, within 1 second, he has his pants on, and we walk to the restaurant, and then the first police car is there already. So we go in. He says to me, Lawrence, this is not good. I said, no, man. So we order, I don't know, Coke and chips. You know, it was a Mexican restaurant. And the guys, the police guys are already there. So we walk out with him. We didn't touch the Coke or the chips. And within 5 minutes, there's five cars. Sheriffs, I don't know, police, highway patrol, whatever. It's all different kinds of police. And at first I thought, okay, this is all about Thomas, you know. But at the end, we both got like, okay. So he turns out around Thomas, hands on the back. What's it called? Handboeien.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. The handchain.
Iron stuff on your
handchain.
Yeah. In the two different cars, we go to the, prison or jail. Yeah. I think it's called jail. Yeah, prison is like a real prison. Jail is like the justice center. But, we're there on the bench, you know, also with our hands in iron, mm-hmm. like sitting next to each other. And then, so we were brought in at 2. And long story short, you know, with everything, what happened afterwards, we got out at midnight. And all charges were gone because first I thought we were just like, two gay cyclists. I don't know what we were doing, but they didn't. Yeah, they thought we were making a public offense, especially to everybody there. But we were just changing pretty quick, you know. And at the end, they noticed and they got us out. But
you didn't have to pay money or anything or leave any.
Yeah, a bill of $185. That was just a bill.
But
everywhere. That was a big thing. That also took hours because it needed to be cash. Luckily, I had enough cash, but Thomas didn't. So then we had to sign. I pay for him, but it needed to be exactly this. Like it needed to be exactly the amount of money. So no change or whatever. And that took like hours to get that all sorted, you know. And then at the end, it's like midnight when you walk out back to the car. It was 1 mile back to the car.
But what was the charge? Like, why?
Just what's it called? I think it's underneath that picture. Decency, okay. Something like that.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And then, like, every month they're just showing the mugshots they made from, like, inmates.
Yeah.
And, fucking hell.
That's in the newspaper. Yeah, those mugshots.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but you, it's the same as to the fight. You have so many emotions, you know. At first, I was alone in the cell, and then I got really angry with Thomas. You know, like it's always the same. And he comes in, and we start to talk, and then we got really hungry because we didn't eat for like after 3 hours of training, nothing to eat. So we got at 5 p.m. we got something and it tasted like heaven. Well, it was like garbage, of course. And then he fell asleep and I got angry again with him, you know, like, the motherfucker is sleeping now. And then we got hungry again. And then, how late would it be? And it's 8. And then it turned out to be like only 7 yet or something like that. Yeah, so many emotions. You cannot phone home. Also, I was worried for my wife. We normally don't make appointments to call, but I said, yeah, I'll call you after my training at 2, then it's like 9 p.m. in the Netherlands. And we have Find My iPhone. So I thought she would look at Find My iPhone and then see that I was in jail of Oklahoma, Marietta, but she didn't look at all. She just went to sleep, you know. So I was, you worry about that because you cannot say something to nobody, you know. So that's crazy.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah, that's a good ending to the podcast. Now we have that story out as well.
No, it's never boring, that the gravel racing. It's never boring. Yeah,
obviously. Lawrence, many thanks for your time.
Many thanks, man. I enjoyed speaking to you.
It was a pleasure. And then, I will see you somewhere in the dirt, but latest, I guess, on the after show party or after race party.
Yeah.
I will apply for a VIP pass.
Yeah. No worries. I will get you VIP treatment, you know. No. And even if you win, I'm not angry as a Dutch national coach, you know. Then I'll buy you a lot of beers.
Mate,
how about the German selection? Is there a lot of German riders who want a wild card? You know about that? Or you don't know anything?
I I mean, we have also a lot of guys got already qualified, but from like the pro riders, there are not so many really showing interest. I mean, maybe someone like Yuri Hollmann from Alpecin Koenig, but no, not so many are really, really interested, because I think Dutch is also from Belgium and also Italy, there's more like pride in wearing the jersey, you know, and the Netherlands and Belgium. I think for them doing those kind of races anyway, similar to like a classic, you know, and
pretty normal. Yeah, yeah.
So,
especially the Italians, they are, it's pretty well arranged also by the federation from Italy. Yeah. Like they have the big,
So,
and they have a hotel.
Yeah.
And,
but so in Germany, at least until now, they don't really feel it. I think we will try as to ride together as a nation. Like, I mean, we have a bit more for like, I hope to have a plan. Otherwise, we have not really a big chance against the World Tour guys. Because, you know, I feel like there are just a few really good like German gravel riders who are actually able to compete in the front. You have to be realistic. And I think we...
Like last year, you didn't have anything about...
I was alone. And also the Europeans, I was basically alone, but that was not a national jersey. So it will be good to have like a bit of like a team to work with. But yeah, we will see. Anyway, I think it will be a big fest. Because
The Dutch will work together really well. Yeah. And they're going to kick your ass.
No.
I told them all on the Wheel of Fall Force.
But I already checked the course and I think it will be a spectacle. And the Belgians know how to make bike races. And when you do the after party,
that's going to be good. Exactly. Yeah. No doubt.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much and see you somewhere on the road.
Yeah.